Blog Talk Radio.
Here at ACO Radio, American Communications Online, or any affiliated stations or websites are not responsible for what guests, hosts, or call-ins may say. All programming is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only.
Ground troops spinning around smartly on the planet Earth, Gaia, where we live. This is home out there on a little ball that you can barely see if you're out above the galaxies, where we are with all the radio airwaves and all the higher universes. However, some of us choose to come down here and embody a physical, biological entity. Some people call them ebens. Extra biological entities. And we're going to talk with Jan Aldrich, who happens to be on the planet walking around in a meat suit. And he has been spending many, many years studying others and observing government relations and security and intel. And we're helping our veterans that have worn uniforms in the past with our UFO Association and our UAP Associates. That's right, folks, UFOs, which is unidentified flying objects. However, the latest news is not really news, but because we are archivists, historians, and investigators, researchers, and reporters, we are going to share again when that UAP actually began prior to the latest lingo hashtag name for UFOs is now UAP. Are unidentified anomalous phenomena, are to some people they prefer unidentified aerial phenomena. And nowadays with NASA, we're going to actually get not very much money, I'm hearing, at least in the everyday talk. Yesterday, my friend Jan Aldrich, our UAP Associates reporter, has reminded me that we are going to actually say we're looking for UFOs in public, what we call hashtag news these days. And, you know, they say TV is dead, but radio never dies because radio waves go on forever. So we welcome all you people out there that have ears that want to listen to us tonight and help us form our UFO Association with our UAP Associates and all you citizen journalists out there that are helping us in social media. And we are in the United States of America. However, we have friends in many, many countries and all over Eurasia and Australia, Pine Gap out in the middle of Australia, right? That dot at night you can see is Pine Gap. But tonight we're going to let Jan Aldrich, she is an internationally well-known ufologist, meaning that he has studied UFOs and he has the history of being a historian and now an orator as well with Ace Folklife Historical Society, Historians for American Communications Online. And we have formed a very new platform, but it's actually all the old files that he's been collecting for years. He has a project called 1947. And we're going to delve into that and what all that means for all of you people out there that want to be a UFO experiencer, Maybe you've already been an abductee, contactee, or maybe you know what we're talking about. Maybe you've been in the Center of UFO Studies. Maybe you've been our society, Center of UFOs. I'm going to let him talk about that and all the ones prior, NICAP and ARPA, DARPA, and NARCAP, and gosh, so many, APRO. He knows a lot more acronyms than I do. So let me get Jan Aldrich on here. Jan Aldrich, are you ready to be a UFO or UAP reporter tonight for us?
Okay, yes. So yesterday, not yet, well, yesterday, some news organizations, news organizations went ahead and announced that NASA is going to start a modest UFO investigation program. Has to do with safety, and they have already talked about 11 cases where UFOs came very close to aircraft, and the whole business is one of the things that they want to study. Now, I found some information about UAP. Dr. Richard Haynes, who was a NASA contractor, started using the term back in 1980 for his own work, and he formed an organization called NARCAP, which was also concerned with UFO safety. He would say, hey, I am not running a UFO organization. I am running a aviation safety thing. Now, Dominic Weinstein, who was working with Richard Haynes, Dominic Weinstein is in France, and he's a captain in the police over there, or in the DST, which is sort of equivalent to our FBI. He's been interested in this since the early 90s. So he is working with the French, he was working with the French Space Agency, and he compiled a list of 300 cases of UFOs either being in close proximity to aircraft, that is, crossing the path of the aircraft, being on a collision course with the aircraft, and at the last minute changing so there was no hit. Pacing the aircraft, sitting off the wing, circling the aircraft, other provocative things such as chasing the aircraft, and so NASA is starting from their 11 case collection, while worldwide, though, Weinstein has found 300 cases that fit this bill. Now, yesterday, NBC on NBC Nightly News announced the NASA program. Was very interesting to hear them say that no other space agency has studied UFOs. So fact-checking was not their hot suit yesterday. The Indonesian Space Agency has been working on UFOs for quite a while. The Indonesian Air Force is also, they're working on UFOs. The problem is language barrier. Colonel Salten, he first worked on the Indonesian Air Force Chief of Staff office, and he was a he was essentially in charge of the UFO problem. So he wrote books back in the 60s and 70s about UFOs in Indonesia. Kufos got one of these books, and a scientist I know in Australia, he has an Indonesian wife, so I made copies and sent it to her, and she translated it into English. So it's tells about his workings and investigations of UFOs and UFO cases. He went ahead and put in the files. So when the Indonesian government formed a space agency, he became the head of that. So there is one space agency that was interested in UFOs, and the other one, and most people in ufology know this, that the French space agency has been looking into UFOs back to the 60s. Yeah, that's right. The 60s. So they've had three organizations working within the French Space Agency. The first was Guy Pan, and it went on for a while. Then they went to BRA, which was run by Jean-Jacques Valesco. Jean-Jacques Valesco and Dominic Weinstein came over and met us at one of the MUFON conferences that we attended. And so we were kidding, because we knew that Dominic was an anti-terrorist police officer. He said, here we are, Ed Stewart, Lauren Gross, and myself, and we're sitting there waiting for his plane to land. And he said, you know, this might be a setup. He might get off the plane and we might be all arrested. But he didn't do that. So, and we got introduced to the head of the French Space Agency UFO group, Jean-Jacques Valesco. After that, we planned in 1999 set up a history group, the Sign Historical group. And we met in Chicago at the airport. So we had, once again, Weinstein, Valesco. We had some of the Italian people come in, and people from the U.S. and Canada. And we got an astronomer to address our first session. Some of you may know him. He wrote on the concept of extraterrestrial life. He's written several books. Concept during the Middle Ages was his doctorate. Then he had, current concepts of extraterrestrial life, theories and concepts. And then he did ancient. And he was going to a conference on his own with his peers and everything. But he came over and saw us, and he said, "I'm playing hooky from the conference with my astronomer friends to come over and talk to you about UFOs." And he says, "I'm doing this because I think this is an important subject." So he had the keynote speech to her. Conference, which was about 30 people, and Dr. Swords was there, the people from KUFOS, from KUFOR, and it was very interesting. We set up essentially a history working group about UFOs, and we were fortunate to have some people from overseas that were highly interested, who asked Letzko about what he was doing. He could tell us, but he said, "I can't tell you what the Air Force is doing, the French Air Force, because they're keeping everything on a tight hold." However, I found out recently that they've loosened their grip a little bit, because I got a summary of 600 sightings worldwide, and within that summary are a number of French Air Force and a few French Navy sightings from aircraft. And so that was very auspicious. It's very nice, because before all these the French people are complaining over there, the French ufologists will say the Air Force has such a tight hold on cases that happen to their pilots and things that we know almost nothing about what they're doing. But now they've loosened up a little bit, so now we do have French cases, Mirage fighters, fighters from French aircraft carriers and things like that. So that's really something there. So those are two organizations, space agencies, which have already studied, and in the French case, still studying UFOs. So I tweaked NBC and said, "Hey, have you guys checked this out, that both the Indonesian and the French Air Force the French Space Agency, both space agencies have already considered UFOs, and the French have an active UFO investigation run by the French Space Agency, SNES. So that was interesting. So I got immediately a whole bunch of likes on Facebook when I put that in. So we'll see what NBC has to say. I don't think they're going to run a retraction.
So Jan Aldrich takes on the big National Broadcast Corporation. Is that the NBC you're speaking of? NBC?
That's who I'm talking about.
Oh,
NBC Nightly News.
Oh, my goodness. Let's,
I got on their message site and sent them a message. I, you know, I haven't heard a reply yet. Probably never will hear a reply. But anyways, I did point that out.
Straight.
Yeah.
We'll have to get who was reading the teleprompter. Is that what it's called when they're reading, like the president?
Yep. You know, so that was
teleprompter.
Yeah. So that
Somebody wrote that up.
That's right. The producer didn't do any checking. That's the problem.
Uh-huh. They don't check the history. So this is something that we've been discussing among our journalists, reporters, historians, and also authors. But, you know, folks, you're only as good as you decide to be. And that doesn't matter what you're in. So we are going to discuss that with Jan because some perceived notions of what our reality is can be based on our own personal experiences. But here we come and we compare notes. And like Dan said, there have been these groups from way back in the day. And if you'll pay attention to what our people are doing in the now, we know people have been on the planet way before the 12,000 or the deluge stories of the flood, and just in White Sands, where I got to frequent White Sands, they're doing all these investigations and finding all the footprints with animals, and we know that we're like 23,000 years ago, we had people up against some very gigantic sloths, giant sloths, and this is provable, but you'll just have to do your own homework. So there's things we know about in today's reality that we didn't know even when Jan and I was growing up in the early 50s. Jan and I came about in 67 forward. We're going to claim that doing things. And Jan and I are orb children, meaning that we were interested in orbs. I saw them after death-defying hepatitis and going out of my body and being visited. And they've always been around me. And I really wondered when one visited me once when I was writing for UFO Digest in Canada and on the wall showed me all these amazing things that I didn't understand because they were diagrams. And this is something that sounds very strange, and I don't really talk about it much. Haven't in 10 years, but this is our 10th year anniversary. We're celebrating here with Jan Aldrich, who was recommended by Dr. Bruce Maccabee, who actually was the briefer for the Central Intelligence Agency back in the day. He actually went over and gave briefings on the Central Intelligence Agency, and now I understand we're working with a lot of the retired veterans. And I know that Rick Doty has recently done, in the last year or two, a show with Dr. Stephen Greer, who is a well-known ufologist out there. I remember back in the day when we were talking, before he was known, he was still an ER doctor. I think it was South Carolina. But he's coming up and coming, so people think of him, at least in TV land, because he helped Stephen Bassett and many others go up before Washington, D.C., and that probably didn't change much since 63 with the Kennedy assassinations, but I always wondered, why did the Kennedy assassination have anything to do with Jim Mars and reporting? And Jim, he wrote a book on that, and it all crossed over into UFO studies. So I'm very interested in how we're going to go forward in this international group of the Center of UFO Studies, which Jan and I have been working with for many years. But Jan and I got out of uniform roughly around the same time, which I think that's very strange. But Jan, I was May 10th, 1967, going to Washington, D.C., government's in the Houston Chronicle. Here's a picture of me. It's Ginger Thurmond, T-H-U-R-M-O-N-D. And then later on, Strom Thurmond, who was the senator of South Carolina. He called me when I was at the University of Alabama, and I had investigative services. So I was already an investigator at 28. But he called me about coming to Washington and said, "What do you know about UFOs?" And I said, "UFOs? I still remember what do you mean?" So apparently he was working with Philip Corso. So when my dad took us to Washington, D.C., and we got to go to Smithsonian and do all these run around, that was 80. So my history, Jan doesn't really know, but he's been working with me several years now, at least here. But we both work in a vault, which is interesting. We were both security managers. We were both called adjutants, him for Army, me Navy. But we have a lot of interesting coincidences. Now, Jan, with all these extraterrestrial thoughts coming and going on the planet and people coming and going, they like to talk about the exciting part that has to do with them personally. And some are contactees, some experiencers, and some abductees. But with you experiencing your first orb as a child that really got you interested moving forward, when did you feel like you became a bona fide ufologist? Was it after you got out of uniform in the post office? But when did you claim? Because you asked me that one time, and I thought, isn't that interesting? Because I remember I didn't use it until 2007 when I wrote for Canada. I wasn't allowed to call myself a ufologist, anything to do with UFOs. But Stanton Friedman anointed me back in the day on the Jesse Marcel case in 1975. So we're going to have to talk about this tonight, since we're going to start classifying for the entire world and on cyberspace on radio waves. So when were you, in your own mind, let's say you were indoctrinated, or you accepted the word ufologist? Can you tell me what year that would be?
Well, let's see. I don't think people used the word ufologist for quite a while.
Yeah,
they weren't using it back in the 50s and 60s.
They weren't using it back then, but when I saw ball lightning in junior high, and that got me interested in ball lightning, which of course is, at the time, the Encyclopedia Britannica had a big article about ball lightning. It had discussions of what it could be. It had sightings of ball lightning, theories about ball lightning. Some people said, well, there's a lightning flash, and then you know the after effects of your eyes. Your optical system is overwhelmed, so you see these balls of light. And I was interested to read that because one of the sightings was this woman was sitting in her bed with her husband. The husband was asleep, and ball lightning came into her bedroom, and there were lightning flashes at the time. So that's what this smart guy, this theorist, brought forward. But then he couldn't explain how she woke up her husband, who had been in sleep and didn't see any lightning flashes. He's seen ball lightning. So put that theory to bed right there.
Oh, you're
reading. Edward Ruppelt's the report on unidentified flying objects, which he had written. He had been the Project Blue Book chief from 51 to 53, and so I got interested in that. So I read all the UFO books in the library. There were quite a few, as a matter of fact. And
now we're talking about his report in 49. What year was I'm missing some of my book. So
his book was went on sale in 56, and it covered 51 to 53 when he was the chief of Project Blue Book. Of course, he put a lot of history in his book, which is very interesting because for the longest time, the Air Force was very stingy with information. And he revealed a whole bunch of things that took years for them to come out, the documents. He had he talked about the commander of AMC writing an opinion for AMC, General Nathan Twining, saying the UFOs were real and not any kind of mystical thing, but were actually real things and they should be investigated. He did that by calling his senior staff and leadership together, and they had a meeting and they decided, in fact, they had been asked by the Pentagon for the their opinion, the opinion of AMC. And so he called his senior leadership together, and they hashed it out, and the Colonel McCoy, who was the in charge of intelligence, his he was a colonel, but his slot was commanding general of AMC for intelligence, T2. That was his title. So he was filling a general slot. There were two generals at that meeting besides Twining, General Brent Nell and General Putt. General Putt was really an expert on German aviation. Like he told people, he said the Germans were probably 10 years ahead of us in design as far as aircraft go. Of course, they had a jet in the Second World War. We didn't. But he was a visionary. So he also had input into that report. So they more or less together decided what would be sent back to the Pentagon. And Colonel McCoy wrote the letter, and then under the direction of General Twining, and Twining signed the letter. So everybody says it's a Twining letter, and they act like the general went into his office and wrote the letter. No, he didn't. The way things happen in the military, the staff has a lot of input, especially a general's staff. He's got experts on intelligence, operations, logistics, personnel, admin. So he has all these people keeping him informed about what's going on. It isn't his business to know everything, but all these people are essentially subject matter experts, and he calls on them for the knowledge he needs there. So that's how that letter was written. He called on his aviation and rocketry and other experts in the field, and they looked at the UFO problem and came up with the letter, and then it was written and signed. That's more or less how 1947. Well, Ruppelt revealed that in his book. So for the next 10 years, the Air Force said this letter didn't exist. Until in the 60s, No, it's got no. This letter
was done
before Project Sign.
Oh wow!
In fact,
okay.
one of the reasons they wrote the letter was because they were thinking of having a permanent UFO project, there was another thing called UFOs over the U.S., and that was put together with General Twining's letter, and they requested a permanent investigation for UFOs, and it was approved in January of 48, and it was called Project Sign. There was an investigation from the 2nd of July, 1947, but that was an interim investigation. It had no name. General Twining authorized it because he could start his own project under his own authority. He could do that. But the next time the budget cycle came around, and every year they decide the budget. So the next time the budget cycle came around, if he wanted to continue with that project, he had to request the project be made permanent. So that's one of the reasons that letter was written. But like I said, Ruppelt revealed that in his book that this letter existed. But until about 1968, I think it was, they denied that it existed. So they said, no, it's nothing like that. You know, they didn't say Ruppelt was lying. They just said, we don't have anything like that. So there, you know. So
they purged
when the,
all the records, didn't they? Now you think, according to Ruppelt, he said the psychological effect from the War of the Worlds with Orson Welles and people jumping out of windows or packing up and leaving their families behind or whatever. Mm-hmm. You hear all the stories back in 38 in the radio, since we're on radio, folks. We're not doing anything like that, but some people came on the radio, namely Orson Welles and others. And they did a story, like Jan and I are talking now to you about UFO Association and UAP Associates, which is the new clique in 2022. But back in the day, in 1938, there was Orson Welles on radio, like we are now. But they made this whole big speech before they had television tubes. And it was October 30th, 1938. So Orson Welles presented, maybe you guys have seen the movie, The War of the Worlds broadcast, but later on we have Keanu Reeves in there doing War of the Worlds. But it was mind-changing, and that's a quote, according to the man that wrote Unidentified Flying Objects, which I asked Jan a question about him being a ufologist, but he's explaining that we didn't even use the word ufologist till a certain time. And I remember wondering if we were going to use that with Stanton T. Friedman, but that was 2006 and 2007 with Canada and U.S. So, Jan, this UFO reports from, you know, they had a split in the Pentagon because they used to say there was so much brass in the Pentagon. I don't know if there still is, but they were busy pouring coffee, and you know, a lot of them were complaining and just hanging out till they got their retirement. So through the years, so apparently back in the day they had more brass than they had to do with, but they weren't going to go get on what he called purging files. But at the same time, there were believers and there were non-believers. So they had, and we have that today, folks, in the UFO business. It's all splintered, just like the internet. So some believed in flying saucers and some didn't. Some, because they didn't know, if they didn't want to look stupid, they didn't want to think it was one of ours or from another country. So they didn't have the technology we have today for the original ways of seeing things So unidentified flying objects, whether they were interplanetary or not. But some people did talk about it. So they were bold enough to say what their beliefs were. But like I said, they were top-heavy brass. They had more people than they needed, I guess. And it was 38, the War of the Worlds. And that was before 47 when Jan Aldrich has his project 1947 that he's been working on for us. And I worked on that, but I didn't know it was called anything because I was just picked up in midnight and taken in a van and taken out to talk to Jesse Marcel about the pieces of the original crash and his story. So we were putting together the two crashes that happened, but we had two. One imploded. The other one was supposed to be just set down and had one guy still lived for a while. So we can get into all that heavy story with Jan. But the reason the kids are asking me all the time why, they don't want to hear the history. But the reason it's important is you don't understand how many of us have had to live and see our parents. And it was very shaming to believe in UFOs and to be accused of it. And they thought there was such a huge difference in the civilian world, even among scientists, and they kept it top secret. And so we have this whole splintering of those that either believed in interplanetary spaceships or flying saucers. And the UFO, I guess, Jan, we're going to agree. Are we going to agree to agree or agree to disagree that the report on unidentified flying objects is going to be the start of at least the word UFO? And then we got to go to the history of ufologists, those that...
Well, the first time it was used was in a Canadian document on 3 July 1947, but... And it had been used before Ruppelt, but Ruppelt started using the UFO abbreviation. He's the one that's responsible for that. So they would call them occasionally unidentified flying objects. But he's the one that coined UFO.
All right. So historically, where is that in cyberspace culture or in intelligence?
Well, he started that when he became head of Project Blue Book. He became head of Project Blue Book as a lieutenant.
So do you think
Major
that in
SWAT.
Our, all right, so military, the Air Force, you want to go back to, for all the kids that watch the TV show Roswell and why it's such a big deal?
Well, back in 47, they didn't call them that. They called them flying discs. The official thing was flying discs. And,
okay. What
that,
about
that
fighters
was,
and orbs?
They thought that they should come up with a more respectable name. So that's when UFOs came, or unidentified flying objects came to the fore, and Ruppelt just coined the UFO as an abbreviation. So that's about 51-52 there. Before that, if you go down to the National Archives, you'll find that correspondence about flying discs is 0.09 in the archives file, the decimal file. So the Army and the Air Force. The Navy does everything different, but if you want to go look up UFOs, you have to, for the early days, you have to look at the flying disc files.
Flying disc.
And the decimal
to...
number is 0.09.
Nice. Now, twice before that's
So Ruppelt started it being a little more respectable instead of flying discs is unidentified flying objects. In other words, you don't say they're discs.
because some of them were rectangular and triangular. So that's what happened. Like I was saying, though, about the Twining letter, that did not show up until 67. Now, when I got to go to the archives, some people had already done that, and the Twining letter was already circulating. It was in the Condon Committee report. Now, the Air Force said they didn't have it. So I found it in... for a flying saucer project, or they called it a flying disc project, the Twining letter and the letter from, it wasn't a letter, it was a listing of a UFO sightings. And it was called Flying Discs over the USA. So those two documents were the basis for the request for having a flying, a UFO project. Project Sign was finally decided it was going to be Project Sign. So so I found it in the request for a UFO project. I found it also in the Adjutant General's files. There was a copy of the Twining memo.
Okay.
And there was a copy of the Twining memo at ATIC. Which,
now tell people what ATIC is for. That's an acronym.
Well, ATIC didn't exist at the time, but they took over the files. It's in an AMC file. Let's put it that way. Okay, that's a better way to say it. It wasn't an AMC file. So that's three places it was easy for me to find. So,
well, the top intelligence
that
specialist
was, that
ATIC.
Was the whole idea is we don't know where that letter is. It was very easy to find. So this is the way they've run things. Barry Greenwood says the government is incapable of being honest about UFOs. That's his. That's what he says about the government.
Edward Rittfeldt
most everything
said.
They say, they contradict themselves so much, it's unbelievable. So,
well, didn't Rittfeldt explain that? Because on the very last page of his book, he said about Project Blue Book to swing back to the old Project Grudge philosophy of analyzing UFOs.
Right, yeah, it was. Exactly. Yeah, when he left, that's what was happening.
But write them off. Right? He says all they want to
exactly
do is write them off. As grain
radar operators.
That's what he
said. Yeah, he said it's swinging back to the way after Project Sign, they changed the name. And I think the name is very, it indicates the way UFOs were treated by the top brass at the time. It's called Project Grudge. That lasted from February 1949 into
1951. There's a psychology behind that.
And when
that.
Rupert was put in charge, he was told to, we're going to have a different attitude towards UFOs. And he was told in 1951, he said, we want a new project. At first they called it Revitalized Project Grudge, but then they decided Project Blue Book. So that started in 1952, but... Rupert had already been given the job of starting a new project with new personnel.
Well, I was born the day after Christmas, 1951. So welcome, Project Blue Book, 1952. And I guess that's what most of the kids today, because of the History Channel, which I told you to talk about tonight, and Travel Channel, Discovery Channel, all the channels, they say TV's dead, but live streaming is sure alive because everybody's and their brother wants a TV channel now, and I've even got ACO TV now, so everybody's going to do their own live streaming and making your own YouTube, so I've been doing my part for us. Now, with this thing about you being an expert, which we all know you are, how did you get with Dr. Bruce McAbee? Because you got on a list from somewhere back with the UFO history in the day, because I remember back in when I was active in MUFON, and we had Bigelow involved and the star, what we call them, star something investigators, but it was James Carrion, and then it was Captain McDonald, but you were recommended to me back in the day, and when it was among Men in Black or Women in Black or both, I guess you get Yankee Black is what Rick Doty calls it, because you have your radio signs, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, Echo, you know, all the way up to Zulu, and they named it Yankee, and then a Black, an undercover or classified, top secret or above, or like you say, special compartmentalized, are bred into briefings nowadays. We've got to sort of help people since you and I are doing it our way. We're doing it our way, folks, because Dr. Bruce McAbee helped us with the Central Intelligence Agency and I guess NSA with all the Edward Snowden bringing out people. So it's all trying to become known, and we're open source intelligence with the splintering of the new Internet, if anybody's noticing. So, Jan, with this said, UFO Association by UAP Associates. So we're going to use UFO and UAP. So I've seen a whole bunch of Facebook groups to, you know, on my phone today. I didn't want to get back into social media, but I'm being called by the universe, I guess, to come back. And that's the only place you'll post your stuff lately that I can grab. So I've got to get that all over and cut and paste it over onto our blog or UAP or UFO Association. I've got so many folks, I've got to grab it and put it all in one place, which was Jan's suggestion. But this is a big undertaking. It's very daunting. And Jan is trying to concentrate on all the old files and scanning them and getting them over to University of Mexico, where another gentleman is becoming very well-known and famous. I think he's a member of Mutual UFO Network. I don't even know. Why don't you talk a little bit about where you're at now, but folks, you needed to know the history, and we're going to, I guess you'd say, braid it in, or we call it threads and tracks at the conventions, and we can talk about, you know, Wendell Stevens and Bob Brown, Laughlin. A lot of people only know when the event started happening that it got popular. So I've never been to one of those, folks. I was never allowed. I was what's called a bona fide investigator, private investigator to legal investigator to government investigator to intelligence officers and security and working for FBI files and Naval Investigative Services and collecting the reports and then being in charge of clearances and classified documents and working like Jan over in Germany, but I was in Hawaii. So here we are, folks, now we're retired, offering you how we are forming what we know about all the people that got shoved under the rug are all the information that we're trying to find and help all the people like us that have either been in uniform or out of uniform or retired, willing to work on this. We're volunteers and we're veterans. So Jan, take it away. How can we pull all this together for people and show them what you're doing now versus what Project Blue Book did back then? Because you know all these UAP groups are showing up all over the place on Facebook, social media groups. Back to you.
Well, the official stuff is Project Blue Book files are now available at the National Archives, or you can get microfilms with the Project Blue Book files on them. So And with the Project Blue Book files, there's a number of other files, Air Force Office of Special Intelligence files, the one of the field units, the 4602nd Air Intelligence Service Squadron, the U.S. Air Force, intelligence agency at Fort Eustis. They all have they all had files when Project Blue Book closed. So those are now available. You can get those from the government, but then after 1970, it becomes harder to get things. They claim they're not investigating, and that may be true. For some years, they may not have. They had let it go and just recorded things and put them in files. In fact, the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Public Information said in 1977, we do not investigate any longer. We record them and file them. And one of the places they filed them was the National Military Command Center at Fort Meade. And when people were talking about the 1975 overflights, that's where Robert Todd and Barry Greenwood found the overflight information at the National Military Command Center. And if you look at the documents from that era, they're stamped with National Military Command Center. So the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Public Information is essentially correct. Now, Robert Todd wrote to he sent a lot of Freedom of Information requests to the Office of Naval Intelligence. So he got to know the FOIA officer there pretty well because he was always sending him requests. And most of the time he said, you know, they said, we don't have anything. We have no documents that fit your description. So finally, Todd wrote him a letter one day saying, hey, listen, we found some of these Navy reports that you say you don't have records of. We found them in other places, and they exist. He said, ONI's fingerprints are all over these things. He said, why is that? Well, Freedom of Information, they don't have to answer any questions. You just tell them what documents you want and where you think they are, and they will tell you, okay, we looked for them, and we found them, and they may declassify them or tell you, no, we're not declassifying that. That's still secret, so you can't get it. Or they'll partially declassify it, or they'll say we never had it or we don't have it now.
Can you explain to people about the classification at this point in our conversation? Because you and I both handled classified material, but we also had to classify it. Do you remember when
there were four classifications after the war.
Korea or World War II? Above.
World War II. So it's restricted, confidential, secret, and top secret. So the Eisenhower did away with restricted. Other governments still use restricted. That was the lowest classification, but Eisenhower he said everything that's restricted is now declassified. So he just did away with that classification in 1954.
Now, is the UFO files in the Eisenhower Library, wherever that is, I don't even know, versus Nixon?
There's not much on UFOs in his library.
What about Reagan's? Because Reagan immediately wanted the UFO report. Because I worked during that era.
No, there's not much in there is some stuff in Truman's library. There's some material in almost all the president's library. Now they said they found
they
a big trove of things in Obama's library.
Aha! He scarfed it, did he?
They say it's going to take 5 years to declassify them.
So
well,
it
of course
on
that's...
who was in office.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of documents in Obama's presidential library. And they're saying it's going to take time for them to declassify it. Look, they should be declassified immediately so that the new guys that are running the UFO program can see what the documents say. So it shouldn't take 5 years to do that.
Well, we're always manpower. We always complain manpower, just like we do in law enforcement. You know, they don't want law enforcement, then they do want law enforcement. They do want government, and then they don't want government. So the deal is, how do we get all the people like you right now? You're scanning, and we should have, you know, lots of people helping do this. Even our baby boomers retired helping, you know, if we could trust them not to scarf them or take them. But our trust issues have been part of the whole project as well. So manpower, money, and then why do certain presidents get certain amount of classified to be declassified and put in there?
Because people have asked for it. You know, Clinton had all kinds of, he wanted to know about things, so he's got stuff in his library. There's less in Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Reagan. There's not much in their libraries.
Reagan, you would think, have
there's,
a lot.
There's a very little bit in Clinton's library, but there's not much in the Bush, either of the Bush's libraries that we know about.
The big
cash is in Obama's.
Think about it. Why did Bush's daddy get a big old man? I guess he was from your area, Connecticut? Wasn't the Bushes really
from?
Yeah,
the Bushes are from Connecticut. But
well,
they moved down
to
Texas a long time ago.
Yeah, that's where I met the president. And then my family, you know, catered to the Bushes because they ate at our grocery stores there in Houston. So, you know, my brother-in-law's store, we're married to Wendy, is Gary Finley. So this is part of history where, you know, the Bushes, Mr. and Mrs. Bush and the Secret Services all came into Houston and shopped. And then they had a chef and they asked Gary to help, you know, the chef promote his book there at the grocery store, stuff like that. So that was Houston. That's where I'm from. That's where I met Bush and Reagan. But you're from Connecticut. Were you born in Connecticut, or you just bought a house there? How'd you get
No,
up
I was born in Ohio.
But you're in Bush Country, Connecticut, or Pappy Bush, right?
Well,
so
No. The last Bush I think was that was here was Prescott Bush, and he was a senator. They all moved down to Texas a long time ago.
Well, they moved out,
So
out
when,
before Houston.
In the 60s, Prescott Bush was, he ran for senator again when Goldwater was in. But, you know, that was a massacre for Republicans, so he didn't get it. But he had been senator before.
But he's the one that got his son George Bush, the first George Bush, into office, wasn't he? Helped George get into office.
Yeah, but they don't live up here anymore. They live in Texas.
Well, they
haven't lived here, they haven't lived here since the 60s.
Right, they go visit Kennebunkport, places like that. That's the name, though, isn't it? Hey, well, how did you wind up in Connecticut? Because that's so far away, and that's where Stanton Friedman was over there, like Nova Scotia or somewhere, because, you know, it was really expensive to talk to him. He was way up there, another time zone.
My father was working for National Smelting, I think. And then he went to work for Chase Brass and Copper in Waterbury, Connecticut. So he was there from the early 50s until the 60s. Then he went to work for St. Joseph Lead, which was...
He was following the minerals.
Right. He was a chemist. He was an analytical chemist, so...
Whoa.
St. Joe was, he said, the best place he worked for.
St. Joe.
But it became St. Joe Minerals. It used to be lead. They, you know, the main thing was lead for batteries.
Ah, now we're getting to the nuts and bolts. So
but,
why the ET people picked you, because we need batteries on the planet. But, you know, they use crystals in space, but, you know, down here... Well, we have to.
My dad was he was an analytical chemist. So.
Whoa.
He did. He analyzed silver, and then most of the common metals, you know, like. And when he went to work for when he went to work for. Chase Brass and Copper, they started getting into the exotic metals like titanium. They were in the ground floor on titanium. They let it slip through their fingers. They were in the ground floor of rhenium. They let that slip through their fingers. Vanadium. That's one thing he was unhappy about, because he said, these guys, we developed the way to purify these metals and everything, and they just let them slip through their fingers and let somebody else take over. So he went to work for St. Joe, you know, he was pretty, he was pretty unhappy until he went to work for St. Joe, and he felt they were on the cutting edge of everything.
Well, tell people how this fits with the UFO, because the government came in after World War II. You guys all know how the women were doing the rivets, and, you know, we were all working, I'm saying we as women versus men, but we were all doing a lot of jobs because the men were needed overseas in World War II. Some of the government after that, and you know, with Project Paperclip, which fits into all this, we started to want to do the nuclear atom bombs, and we still say to this day that, you know, when we started doing all that nuclear stuff, they were all watching us from up above back then, and so that's, you know, history now. But your dad was very important, because we were all about mining minerals and getting into the nuclear business, which you had a clearance for. So, you know, all this is all part of the UFO Association now, because we have different ways of looking at the same nuts and bolts of just not the spacecraft, but the people flying it are the beings. And we always knew there were at least four or five minimum that we claimed when, you know, we came aboard. And then some people said 65. You know, Clifford Stone had his number. Was it 57, 59? I forget. My husband had 68, I think, or 69. I like to remember that because he said 69 was his favorite number. I don't know how many Albert Rosales has, but do y'all have a list in your history groups from the old days that kept up with the alienologists, for the alienologists listening, that keep up with the various types of Ebens or aliens or those that look like, you know, grays, tall or white or the light blue skin or any of that? Do you have any data that you're finding on other than the Roswell crash?
Well, we, you know, there's always, in 1973 was, you know, a big reporting thing for years, a lot of people call it the year of the humanoids. So there's,
so how many?
There were all kinds of unusual reports in 1973.
Yeah.
And Dave Webb was, Dave Webb, Ted Blocher, Dr. Harder, to a certain extent, Isabel Davis. They were all looking into that kind of thing.
Did they only say they were undercover or underground only? Because when
nobody said they were underground. I don't know anybody. Well, I do know people that believe that, but I don't. I don't think so. All these things were associated with UFOs. You don't see UFO occupants running underground.
Well, I think what they meant was they took them underground, but then, you know, some of the folklore, which we have to separate.
Yeah, well, that's what I think that is folklore, because there's no...
Uh-huh.
Anyways, Dave Webb was one of the big guys that did humanoid studies.
Okay.
So he turned about half of his files over to Barry Greenwood, and so they're going into the scanning project.
Was he a scientist, or was he in
he
the
had
government
huge,
underground?
He had huge numbers of reports of these humanoids. So he had what he called the Humcat, and he and Blocher worked on that. So I have some of the stuff that Ted Blocher did, and Kufos had a lot of stuff that Ted Blocher did. So putting this all together, it's quite a collection. And that's what we're trying
to
do. We're trying to put all this stuff together. People like, a lot of people still have their own files and investigations, like Walter Webb, Dave Webb, James McDonald. His most of his material is at the University of Arizona. So I just got through with going to Rice University and looking at Dr. Richard Haynes's material. And he was interested in aircraft sighting, so I got to see his material. Got material for the scanning project from there. Erica Luke's got Ann Druffel's files. So that's a pretty big set of files. And we got Anthony Huenas, who had contacts all over the world. He used to go speak all over the world. So like he said, everywhere he went, people gave him magazines and books and things. So he had this giant collection. So We got most of the case files from him years ago, but now we have all his files. So Dave's working right now on 88 boxes of UFO material that he's trying to get into organize it so Kufos can use it. So
now, which Dave are you talking about? The one in Mexico that's MUFON?
Yeah, Dave Mahler. He went and picked up Antonio's files, and Antonio had TV program, and he also did blogs before there were blogs, and he did a lot of speaking, and he went all over. He went to South America, he went to Japan, he went to China, he did work in Europe, so he has stuff from all over.
That's
so
be
I went down and got I went down and got Dr. Willie Smith's files. And he had
in
what
Florida?
Was called the Unicat. So Willie Smith worked with Hynek.
But Willie Smith in Florida down here where I'm in Gulf Breeze, but he was what, Miami? Where did you go in Florida to pick
He was in
up?
South
was
Miami.
Miami. Okay. Now, that's where J. Allen Hynek went to recuperate for his cancer, right?
Right. Yep.
So, now did you meet him? You said you weren't at Willie Smith's when you went there after he passed, right?
Because that's right. I never met Hynek.
That is so strange because you're doing so much work for him and his organization. That do you give J. Allen Hynek the creation or the university? Because how do we? He started the Center for UFO Studies himself in Chicago, right? He is the founder?
Right. So
now
he was the Air Force scientific advisor for Project Blue Book.
Right.
Or
that's
really
how he,
for Project Sign, Project Grudge, and Project Blue Book.
That's how he got famous, I think.
He was
and
there
then
for
he
more.
Started.
He was there for most of the 20 years that the government had the UFO investigations.
But he got involved from the
university. So they would ask him to look at cases and everything, and they would send him files. So he has files.
You said over nine.
The government has lost.
What do you mean the government?
So
lost?
He has files because they sent him copies of a lot of things. And so if you're looking for something and you can't find it in Project Blue Book, then one of the next places to look is Kufos to see if Hynek had it. Because he wasn't very good filer and everything, but that's one of the reasons that Dave is trying to get all these files organized.
Right. Well,
so,
think about
so
it.
What Kufos had and what NICAP had and CSI New York and CSI Los Angeles had, that's pretty well organized. And what Hynek had, that's pretty
well
organized now.
Who got Carl's out of Wisconsin? Carl for Afro. Did J. Allen Hynek?
Carl's files are down in Arizona, and the people that have them aren't going to give them up.
Oh, no. So they can't be public at the museums or libraries? They're not in
nope.
any presidential file, nothing. They're just...
Nothing.
So that's the difference, folks.
So,
Part
of the files were microfilmed. But, you know, we got so many con men in ufology.
They want
that,
to save it, like archaeologists. What do they call those people that steal art you know, they're not con men.
Grave robbers. Yeah, there's
grave robbers. We have grave robbers in the UFO business.
Had one of the microfilms, and we you know, I didn't know this. I was just talking to him one day. He says, "Deist, the APRO files," and he says, "There was made."
You
I said,
to
"Oh,
say
really?
That again. You bet. Say that one more time. You drop." I don't know why, but the airwaves.
Three microfilms were made of the APRO files up till 1972. So from pre-47 to 1972.
Well, her husband.
Three
died,
microfilms were made.
They didn't die till the 80s, like 86 and 89, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, but that's the last time the microfilms were made. So Brad says, Brad's talking to me. He says, we got to trace these down. He said, I have tried to trace them down because after the Lorenzens died, two of them went to Bill English and then they disappeared.
Oh, no. That's not
so good. He said, but I've got the first one. I said, oh really? So you've got the first one. What does the first one run? He said it goes from pre-47 to the December 1956.
That's good.
And I said, so we're not going to get the 1957 flap from you, huh? And he says, no. So he sent me the microfilm. I copied it into about 12 copies. So. It wouldn't get lost, so other people would have it. That's what I did. I distributed that around. So Barry Greenwood's got a copy.
Barry Greenwood. Who else? Yeah, give us your 12 choices. You've decided to make a dozen.
Well, Kufos has got a copy. Fufor's got a copy. Ron Dyke has got a copy.
You give it one to Bufon?
Lauren Gross has got a copy. I think I sent one to AFU. There's some other people I sent them to.
Will you make us a list in your Project 1947, your 12 choices? Or the Carl Lorenzen file. But that's only one small part.
We had almost 400 microfilms.
And you've only got one.
About say 300 About 250 were government microfilms.
Carl Lorenzen got?
No, that I had.
No. Okay, you're off of that. Okay. You have
I'm off
400
of Carl.
Microfilms.
Carl had three microfilms made.
Okay, three. You had 12.
So the government had Project Blue Book. That's 106 microfilms.
Okay. So we're up to 109.
The radar cases, radar photographs, and the Air Force Office of Special Investigations
LSI
files. So...
You have a microfilm of
I guess
that?
I think there's nine files.
109,
the other thing we had is the Project Sign microfilms. There's nine of them, but we only have seven.
So we should have 118 and nine is 127?
Right.
Okay.
Then there were some specialized films. There was two after Life Magazine. They got after Life Magazine, and then Look Magazine did an article on UFOs in 1952.
So are those on my
The Air Force phone? Got bombarded with letters.
Wow.
People asking questions, people giving them theories, but a lot of these letters were sightings all the way back to the 19th century.
Right. And they're always
so
in
there's
our artwork.
There's two microfilms of that. So there's probably about 1,000 sightings on those microfilms.
So we don't have anything from the 1800s unless it's in books or art form.
Yeah,
art.
Books or newspapers.
Okay. So everybody knows that. So we're going to start at the 1900s, or do we start strictly 1943, 38? Because Lorenzen saw her UFO, and she was the one that got interested.
Well, I got two microfilms that are Night Fighter Squadrons, all the operational and intelligence reports for each Night Fighter Squadron. So if you look on
what
my
year?
Site, 43 to 45.
So you want to tell people why we're doing it linear with time? Because even though we may think now quanta or universal or whatever you want to call it, here on this planet, we're still talking timelines. And we're using a benchmark for World War II for the UFO Association, folks, just so you know. And that's just how we've got to do it. And if you've got anything before World War II, so much was destroyed. You know, that's why they called it a world war. So they started to demolish World War One and World War
Two.
There was
a file that the FBI had. I haven't seen it. I've seen stuff from it. It was from the First World War.
Wow, the FBI.
And
it was called
German airships because people were reporting strange things in the sky, and the FBI was keeping a file on them.
Nice, yeah. Call them Luftwaffes, is that how they said it? It was German, because the hydrogen, they had some, that was the latest traffic.
Well, that's what they thought, you know, people thought they were, but if you look at the cases, a lot of them are UFO-like.
Yeah.
So, So people like Orville Hartle in Indiana, he used to come up with a lot of early cases like that.
So you go by people that were historians or researchers. How do you guys, after Carl Lorenzen, how do you find all these people? Because I've only gone back to her in Wisconsin. So who do we go before her?
Well, Orville Hartle was one of the first NICAP subcommittee chairmen.
What year?
So he had Indiana Unit 1, and he started in the 50s. So he was a real careful investigator. He went out, he recorded interviews with people he talked to, and he had stuff going all the way back to the 1909.
When I was indoctrinated in 67 and 68 through Chris Kraft and NASA, the underground after Carl Lorenzen, they came down and made the Texas Mutual UFO Network group. But before that group got there, I was taken over to a man's house. I still remember where it was in southwest part of the I wanted to remember, but it was late at night and it was dark, but he had behind a wall in his house, he had all this library. Like, you walk into a library with that many books stacked up to, like, his ceiling, you know, where the of all books, it was nothing but files and books in Houston. But he had something to do with astronauts and NASA. I was just a teenager, like 16, 17 years old, being indoctrinated with, you know, IBM and TRW and NASA and, you know, what contractors were, all of that. And I got to go listen to the, you know, like a secretary listening to the headphones when the men walked on the moon. But I know they walked on the moon, and I told you I heard, you know, bogeys 10 o'clock high. So that was part of my indoctrination. So there are individuals. Would you happen to know who that is, Jan?
I got no idea.
I don't either. But
no.
I know there was at least one. It was a secret. So you're saying
so
that you
Isabel
have no
Davis in New York, and she was one of the early
known people.
1950. They had these. They had a group called the Civilian Saucer Intelligence in New York City.
Have you got any of that?
So, Alexander Mabain was the leader of the group, but before Alexander Mabain, Isabel Davis, and Ted Blocher, they were the big three. They were the research committee.
Okay, only for New York.
Before that, the organization was run by John DuBarry, who was the editor of True magazine, so you see all the True articles. So he was part of the Dr. S. N. Baruch, who was a relative of Bernard Baruch, and Bernard Baruch's son was in the Navy. He was a naval reservist, and he's the one that came up with service reports, instructions for reporting vital intelligence. Bernard Baruch Jr., he was the one that was, he's the one that invented service. Service reports started flowing through the system in 1951 and have never stopped. So when they told Congress, oh, we don't know what's going on right now, these guys are either ignorant or they're lying.
They don't
because
believe
service reports have stopped flowing through the system. Now,
doesn't U.S. Congress have their own library?
See any reason? The Canadians do not see any reason to classify service reports. So they let them go public. But the Americans are, they classify everything. So you'll see service reports from the 50s and the 60s around the Blue Book time, but you won't see very many afterwards.
And
but if you look at the Canadian stuff,
right?
If you look at the Canadian stuff, they have not classified that. So because of NORAD. Canada and the U.S. are in NORAD. So there's two different philosophies here. The Canadians do not think that UFOs are a threat. So what they did is they did not classify service reports, but the Americans are paranoid, so all the service reports coming through the system are classified, and they denied for decades that they had any service reports. And then
jobs, military jobs. So the Air Force got trapped with that. And still, basically, because the Air Force is still going to control the UAP branch. Isn't that the way it still is? Some things never change.
No, the Navy's supplying the manpower now. The Air Force isn't doing anything.
Well, I was always
okay, let
naval.
Me talk about a little bit about this service reports because it's important. People can't get this through their head that they never stopped reporting UFOs through the service system.
Okay.
All these guys that think they know everything, they don't know anything. Service reports started in 51 and they've continued up to 2022. We know this because we can see the Canadian ones. The Americans said, we don't have any files. So years ago, Bernard Thuinay, he was the editor of BSD magazine in France. He asked for an interview with the NORAD commander. So he went to NORAD, and he asked the NORAD commander about UFOs, and he says, well, we get them, but we don't have any budget to investigate them. It wasn't quite the truth. But anyways, he asked about service reports, and no, there's nothing there. But there's a whole bunch of Canadians in NORAD, and they speak a lot of them speak French. So Bernard, while he was there at NORAD, he got asking around, and one of the Canadians said, oh, yeah, these things, they come in here all the time. We just put them on microfiche. And so I said, okay, that's a good rumor. But then Ann Druffel wrote to Secretary of Defense Brown and said, I have been told that service reports are not saved, but I have a fighter pilot from Korea, 1957, that said he submitted a service report and he would like to see it again. So then the Air Force wrote in answer to her letter saying, we do have files of service reports, but so many agencies are involved, we can't declassify them. They will be difficult to declassify them. So they admitted that they have these things, even though they've been telling people, we don't investigate anymore, we don't do this, or we don't do that. Service reports never stop. JANEP 146 that told you how to make them and who would do it and how it would be handled has been superseded. But there are still instructions on how to do service reports. And service reports still flow through the system. And like I said, the Canadians don't consider them classified. So if it starts with a Canadian facility or a Canadian airliner or the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, they're not classified. And about 25 to 30 years ago, I'm not sure exactly what, Chris Rakowski was, he was at some meeting and there was some talk about service reports and, you know, Canadian UFO reports. And there's, you know, the government people were saying, you know, these are a pain in the neck. Dr. Milliken. He was in charge of these. It's called the non-meteoritic files. In other words, anything that was that came through official files that wasn't a meteor or aircraft or anything like that, they went into the non-meteoritic files. And Rakowski said, "Well, why don't you send them to me?" So, a little while later, he was contacted. He said, "You're the point of contact for UFOs in Canada. All official reports that go through the Canadian government, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the military, the non-meteoritic file, service reports, reports from Transport Canada, they will all come to you." And so for about 25 years, he's been getting these things. And he just turned his files over to he works at the University of Manitoba. He just turned these files over to the University of Manitoba. So they will be scanned and public. Because, as I said, Canada doesn't classify these things. So that's a view. What the Canadians are doing is a view into what the Americans are doing. So the Americans want to classify everything, and the Canadians are not into classifying UFO reports. So we can watch what the Canadians are doing, and we can see what's going on in North America. And that's going to be at the University of Manitoba. And there's enough money there for the scanning project on the Canadian reports to begin. And Rakowski gave University of Manitoba the government files that they gave to him and his own files. So they have enough money now. They had one of those, what do they call it when you, Kickstart or something like that. I forget what it was. Anyways, I had some money Project 1947. I had people that sent me money. So when they got a certain amount in their GoFundMe, that's what they called it, GoFundMe. When they got a certain amount in their GoFundMe funds, I gave them the Project 1947 money that people have donated over the years, and so now they have money to the university has money to scan these things.
So, which university did you give the money to?
The University of Manitoba.
Manitoba to Canada.
Right, because it's, these are Canadian UFO reports, and Chris Rakowski works at the University of Manitoba, and he's the point of contact for UFOs in Canada.
Okay, well, so much for made in the USA. We're all one and the same on the planet, so as long as we're all UFO hunters, UFO associates, ufologists, alien
So he has... He has the prior they put things on microfilm.
Okay.
So the Canadian, that's another set of microfilms we have is the Canadian.
How many do you have of those?
Up to the 70s, I got from the Canadian archives a number of microfilms with the Canadian reports on there.
Okay. Wow. So
that's part
of that.
Part of that 350 microfilms that we have.
Goodness sakes! So all of that's going to the University of Mexico, plus the University of Manitoba. And is this all under Project 1947, or does each human...
No, Rakowski's doing the Canadian stuff.
Well, each humanoid on the planet, or each biological, are what do we call the humanoid species? So sentient, intelligent beings of the UFO Association. They're not all called historians or ufologists or researchers. Do they, some of them analysts, some are investigators, some journalists, reporters, researchers, some writers, bloggers, vloggers, some are videographers. You know, we have all types, but every group.
So Rakowski's been putting stuff on his blog. He has a blog.
Famous
UFO.
What,
UFO Research Manitoba. That's his blog. UFO Research Manitoba. So for years he's been putting official Canadian reports on his blog. Plus things that he investigates, plus things that people send him. So if you want to know something about UFOs, you know, everybody thinks they've got all the information. No, there's all kinds of sources of information that people don't even realize exist. So Chris Rakowski's blog is called UFO Research Manitoba. And so what I've been doing is, he puts official reports on his blog too. So I've got 2022 service reports that he's put on his blog or elsewhere. Sometimes he puts them on Facebook of reports. A few years ago, I asked him, how far does the service reports go? He says, 2019. It's the last one I got. So just a little while ago, he started putting some up on his Facebook page. He said, you know, since I talked to you, I've got these. So he has these reports that, and like I said, the Canadians are in NORAD, but they have a different philosophy than the Americans about UFOs. So if we watch what the Canadians do, we get an insight as to what the Americans are doing.
Well, it says according to...
And to me, that's amazing, but all these people that know everything about UFOs, they don't. It's really so as far as the official government goes, that's, and the same thing with the French. So I'm going through and I'm doing Project Blue Book. So we used to have air bases in North Africa, and Morocco used to be associated with the French. So we had an air base in Morocco. So I got this report from the U.S. air base in Morocco. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's very interesting. But then here's the French. They put on their website, here's a report from a guy that served at the air base in Morocco with the Americans. And that's the same report I got from Project Blue Book. This guy he was there then, and he was involved, but from the French side. And it's on the Gipan. It's on their website. So I'm saying, you know, this is amazing. So, the Americans were all over the place. So, in Australia, I got several reports from the Australian government UFO site that are American military pilots reporting stuff to the Australians while they were in Australia. Same in New Zealand, same in England, same in Canada. And like I said, in France. And so we also have things from the South African government in Blue Book, the Uruguayan intelligence, is there's stuff from Uruguay in Blue Book. There's stuff from Brazil in Blue Book. There's stuff from Argentina, Chile. NICAP had an investigative subcommittee in Chile, so they sent in stuff to NICAP. Now the Chileans have a government, semi-official government investigation, and they were giving stuff to Richard Haynes. So I looked at their files. I was very amused. They're trying to organize their UFO thing down there. And the Chilean Navy says, we're kind of miffed about the Americans. And so Haynes said, can you find out what the problem is? So in Antarctica, in 1956, they had this expedition down there. Several guys, they got, there was a UFO, it interfered with their equipment. They made a report. When they got back, they made a report. The guys that made the report don't remember where it went, but they made it on U.S. Air Force questionnaires. And then the Chilean Navy said, we sent these to the U.S. Navy through the U.S. Embassy in Santiago, Chile. And we never got any feedback. So they're unhappy about something that happened 70 years ago. So are we still on?
Yeah, we're still on. They'll probably cut.
Okay, so
that's
I think that's kind of an amusing story. Now, the last living person from the Robertson Island expedition was just in the newspapers, and he also talked about that UFO case and filling out the paperwork, and it went to the United States. So that's interesting. So somewhere, because it's not in Project Blue Book, somewhere there's a UFO report from Antarctica from the Chilean expedition. But it's not in Project Blue Book. Oh, let me talk to you about some of the other microfilms. Lynn Cato worked at the Library of Congress. So some of the money that was put aside for the Air Force when they did the Condon Committee, the Library of Congress got money. And she was in charge of UFOs, Lynn Cato was, for the government.
The government was doing this. So she was supposed to make a bibliography of all the books about UFOs and journals and articles and things like that. So she did this. It's a big book. You could still get it. It's available on Amazon, as a matter of fact. It's a government book. But she also got Isabel Davis's, she put together four scrapbooks for CSI New York and NICAP. And it's more than four scrapbooks, but it turned out to be four microfilms. And that's part of the government project. They microfilmed those scrapbooks that Isabel Davis had. And, you know, those are available to the public. They've been available to the public since 1968. Nobody's taking advantage of it. I called down to the Library of Congress when I started Project 1947, and I said, what do you have there from, is Lynn Cato still there? Can I talk to her? And the librarian told me, no, she's not here. I don't know who she is. He said, I never met her. I said, you know, I talked about the UFO project with him. And he says, I'll take your number and call you back. I never expected to hear from him again. About 3 days later, he says, you know, we got a whole bunch of microfilms here in the vault. Some of them have never been developed. I can send you copies of them if you want them. He said, it's going to cost you a little bit of money. And I said, yes, send me copies. So that's another 100 government microfilms that I got. It's mostly stuff, though, that was done in the private sector, except these really important four microfilms of CSI NICAP scrapbooks. Because whatever happened to those scrapbooks when NICAP fell apart, nobody knows. So they're on microfilm. So the government saved those for us. So, and I, you know, I like to have them because I always felt that Isabel Davis was my mentor. Whenever I go down to NICAP, I would see her. So I go down to Washington, see, and stay at NICAP for a while. You know, when I was on leave sometimes. So, and I always felt that she was my mentor. She told me, she showed me how to do investigations, how to research and things like that.
Well, I guess tonight we're going to have to call it a night, but can you come back Friday or Saturday night or both, or you want to plan on next week? We'll see which one, folks. Whatever happens will happen. We're playing with each other, hoping we're still alive, being baby boomers. And
that's what I'm worried about. I'm trying to get all my stuff organized so somebody can come and get it if I...
You transition.
I've sent 43 boxes already to New Mexico.
Wow. Thank God I was just a PR or ambassador of goodwill for all this. All I had to do is sit back, observe, and tell people, yeah, I'll keep it out there going. I didn't have any clue when they told me. They said, well, how did you do it before? And I said, computers. And I was like, wait, where did that come from? But that was asked that in 94, but you know, J. Allen Hynek asked me in 85, but you know, Chris Kraft asked me in 67. So the government did. It said Washington, D.C. I don't know if that was the Pentagon or who. It was Yvonne McCutcheons, whoever that. She was the recruiter, Yvonne McCutcheons of Houston. So she was a government person. And then Carl Schleicher, I found out, the smoking man, right? He was Air Force down there and snooping around us young kids at NASA, all that, hanging out with Dr. Richard Allen Miller. And then that was Edgar Mitchell. So they all got with that stuff on the moon and all that, you know. So it's all one big family, folks, believe it or not. Everybody knows everybody, but most of them are passing over now, so we're trying to play catch-up with Jan Aldrich, who was appointed for Alien Contact Org, ACO, UFO Association, between Stanton T. Friedman and Dr. Bruce McAbee. So we'll take this up again. I guess we'll try for Friday, if not Saturday, or we'll just see, maybe both.
Yeah, Jan's that's right. Fine. Yeah.
You're doing good, Jan. As long as your breath holds out, we'll keep doing oral reports. And we never know what's going to come out. It's whatever comes off the top of his head or he's got notes on. And then we'll just keep going. And if you want to come on the other nights of the week, I know there's a lot of guys, the MUFON guys and different state heads want to come on. So, yeah, you just have to call me. I don't mind providing the platform. Just let me know. Jan, if you have anybody else that wants to come on and talk about their files, let me know. But in the meantime, you've got the star position as the UFO reporter right now for us. So you're doing a good job. We appreciate it. And it's given a lot of people, you know, ways to know these names that they may not know, that some of us just have names memorized, but some of us don't. So we're just trying to offer it as of June 2022. We're all working together out here in cyberspace culture, folks. All right. Well, I will be glad to man the studio and push the buttons next week for you, Jan. Just you said
okay.
You prefer 7 year time instead of 8 Eastern.
Right, right, yeah, seven Eastern time.
And you prefer Friday over Saturday, or it doesn't matter, or both?
Yeah, I think Friday's better.
All right, Friday at 7. I'm going to do my best to show up. That means I show up Central 6, 5 Mountain, and 4 Pacific. And we're 5 hours different between Hawaii, so 7 would be 2 p.m. Hawaii. All you Hawaii folks. All right, and around the world, you know your time. So we're, you know, just go by Eastern, which where Jan is. So we're going to block everything off at 7 Eastern for our next Friday. All right, same time, same station, this time for sure. Friday, 7 Eastern, folks. And we'll continue oral reports with Jan Aldrich of Connecticut for the UFO Association and UAP Associates. And if you've got any UFO or UAP groups, let us know about them. And make sure we get your link for your blog in our directory. Thank you, Jan. Look forward to next week, okay? You did a good job.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
See you then.
Thank you for your support. All right. Goodbye. All right. Here we go, folks. We're going to do some, just a little music to get off at the station. All right. Here we go.
Sweet dreams are made of this. Who am I to disagree? Travel the world and the seven seas. Everybody's looking for something. Some of them want to use you. Some of them want to get used by you. Some of them want to abuse you. Some of them want to be abused.